Exodus chapter 11, verses 1 to 10, and overview of the plagues. The 13th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on September 4, 2016, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 11, Exodus chapter 11, verses 1 to 10, and overview of the plagues accompanies this talk.
We'll be looking at the book of Exodus again. A few weeks ago, we were looking at the section on the plagues. I went through the first 9 plagues. There is one yet to go. But I've been wanting to get to this point so I could talk about the plagues as a whole, because there are a number of things that I'd like to talk about with respect to the plagues as a whole. But I've decided that I really need to do chapter 11 before I do that. So I'm going to jump into chapter 11, and it's not a long chapter. I'll go through that. And then I will start in talking about the plagues as a whole, but I will not finish that this week. I'll have to finish that next week. Just to remind you, it'll be important, where we left off at the end of the 9th plague, which is the end of chapter 10, is that the 9th plague, as you'll recall, is darkness. And darkness came over Egypt like Egypt had never seen before. And Pharaoh, as he's done on 2 other occasions, came to Moses asking for relief, asking for Moses to pray to God to dissipate the plague, in this instance, darkness. And as Pharaoh has done on a couple of other occasions, he offers to let them go. He says, you can go now. And in the past, he's always had restrictions on that that were such that Moses turned down the offers. In this instance, he gives up all of the restrictions on people, but he said, you have to leave your animals behind. So there's still a restriction. And Moses said, no, we don't know what God is going to require of us when we go to serve him, so we have to take our animals with us. And at that point, Pharaoh becomes angry and says, I don't want to see you again. If I see you again, you die. And Moses' response to that is, you won't see me again. And so that's where we left off at the end of chapter 10. But as you get into chapter 11, it is apparently the case that that conversation wasn't over at that point. It's going to continue. There's going to be more that is said there at that juncture at the end of the 9th plague and before we get to the 10th plague. So that's where chapter 11 fits in. As best as I can piece it together, then, in chapter 11, there are 3 parts to this chapter. The first part is what God said to Moses. And it may be an aside. It's not exactly clear how this fits in and when it happened. We'll talk about that in just a second. But that's the first 3 verses. Then 4 through 8, Moses then talks to Pharaoh and tells him about this 10th plague that is coming. And then verses 9 and 10 kind of summarize the situation. The author takes a little break here and says, here's where things stand. Before then, in chapter 12, he launches into a discussion, a kind of digression on the Passover and the celebration of the Passover. Okay, so those are the parts. I'll read the first part. Now the Lord said to Moses, one more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people, that each man ask of his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. For furthermore, the man Moses himself was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. It's not clear to me when God says this to Moses. In the narrative, Moses is standing before Pharaoh, and it's possible that God is speaking to him there as he's standing before Pharaoh. But my suspicion is that that's not the case. My suspicion is that this was said to Moses before he went to see Pharaoh at this point in time. In any case, what he says to Moses is, there's one more plague coming, and these plagues have been building to a climax, and this last one is going to be the climax, and we'll be talking about it at some length. Then it says that after that one more plague, that is the 10th plague, then he's going to let you go. In fact, he's going to drive you out of here. So God is assuring Moses that that's going to be the outcome of all of this, and that's important. I'll get back to that in just a second. He then says to Moses, tell the people, tell the Israelites, to ask of their Egyptian neighbors for pieces, articles of gold and silver. And God has prepared them such that the Israelites will have favor in the eyes of the Egyptians, and they will be generous, and they will give up those items of silver and of gold. It goes on to say that Moses was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. It doesn't mention Pharaoh here. He's esteemed by the people in general and by Pharaoh's servants. It doesn't say whether he's esteemed by Pharaoh at this point. I think that this section is here as reassurance to Moses that things are on track, things are going to turn out well, and you will be cared for. I suspect that that's important at this juncture because there have been these 9 plagues that have all come on the people of Egypt because the Pharaoh would not let the Israelites go. This could have played out differently. It is not hard to imagine that in this situation that the people of Egypt might have turned on the Israelites and killed them all. That would have been a way to get rid of them. But that's not what happens, and that could be what they would have been afraid of at this point. They could have been afraid that all of this would just bring about hostility towards the Israelites. But God has worked out things differently. And the way that the Egyptians seem to be looking at it is that there is this God who is the God of these Israelites, these Hebrews, and he has been acting on their behalf, and he is more powerful than our gods. He is more powerful than our Pharaoh, and it would be too risky for us to take any action against those people because they've got quite a champion on their side. So apparently that's the dominant thinking on the part of the Egyptians. Now, some of the Egyptians, I'm sure, would just like to get rid of the Israelites. Give them money and send them out of here. Others are probably somewhat sympathetic with the Israelites. They've seen them in their plight and the sufferings that they have undergone as slaves, and they may be empathetic there, that their plight has become known to the Egyptians as a whole, and they may be empathetic. And there are others who are probably actually won over, that they have come to respect not only the Israelites, but their God. And we know later on, we'll see in Exodus, that went out of Egypt a mixed multitude. And the assumption is that includes some Egyptians that would have gone out with them. So some were probably even won over. And as a result of all of this experience, see God as the one true God. In any case, this section, I think, is intended to reassure Moses and the Israelites that everything is right on target. Everything is going the way that it was planned, and they are going to be freed. They are not only going to be freed, they're going to be expelled, but they will leave with wealth. They will be in good shape when they leave. Okay, now Moses is going to speak to Pharaoh in verse 4. And Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight I am going out into the midst of Egypt. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstones. All the firstborn of the cattle as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and such as shall never be again. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog shall not even bark. whether against man or beast, that you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And all these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, Go out, you and all the people who follow you, and after that I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. So here he's announcing the final plague. And the final plague, it is a really frightening plague. All of the other plagues have been less deadly. They started out as just a nuisance. But as we've progressed through the plagues, they've become more than a nuisance. They have become, well, their food. The main thing that was affected was their food supply. So in that sense, life-threatening. But then as we get to the last few plagues, there are people that die and there are animals that die, but not in the magnitude of the last plague, the 10th plague. In this one, the firstborn throughout Egypt are going to die, the firstborn of people and the firstborn of the animals. And it was going to affect every strata of society, from the very highest ranking in Egyptian society to the very lowest ranking in Egyptian society. All will be affected by this plague. There will be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has never been before, and such as there shall never be again. So a huge shot, a huge blow to Egypt. Everyone will be affected. But as we've seen before, and this is an important theme going through these plagues, God is going to make a distinction. That is to say, the Egyptians will be impacted, the Israelites will not be impacted by the plague. I say there's been a theme throughout. I think that we are to understand that the first three plagues affect everybody. So the nuisance impacts even the Israelites, I think. But when the plagues become more than just a nuisance, then God makes a distinction and only the Egyptians are affected by them. That becomes very important. God is protecting his people in the midst of all of this. The impact on Egypt and its society will be so great that Moses says, all these your servants, he's talking to Pharaoh, but apparently he's talking to Pharaoh with an audience of his advisors there with him. And all these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, Go out, you and all the people who follow you. That's interesting. It's the servants who are going to beg, are going to give permission to the Israelites to leave. It doesn't say that Pharaoh is going to give permission at this point. So Pharaoh is in a situation where, as it plays out, Pharaoh is going to lose his power. It's true of any autocrat. In the absence of the cooperation and the help of his population, he can't do anything of significance. And Pharaoh is being brought to that place where the population and even his advisors are in favor of, they've been brought to their knees. They want the Israelites gone. They want the request to be complied with. And so they are going to insist, and the Israelites will leave. And then it says that Moses went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. It's interesting, at the end of chapter 10, Pharaoh was the one who was angry. And he says to Moses, get out of here. Next time I see you, you're a dead man. So he is angry at Moses and all that Moses stands for. Here, towards the end of chapter 11, it's Moses who leaves in anger, and his anger is at Pharaoh for Pharaoh's stubbornness and his refusal to bow down before Yahweh. The last section then, and as I mentioned before, I think this is just summarizing the situation. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that my wonders will be multiplied in the land of Egypt. And Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh. Yet the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go out of his land. What this is summarizing is the situation that's been building, that there have been these 9 plagues of increasing severity over an extended period of time. We'll talk about how long that period of time is later. But it's been over an extended period of time. So things have been building, and clearly the inhabitants of Egypt are becoming increasingly concerned about what's happening and what can be done to stop these plagues. But Pharaoh is adamant, who continues to be stubborn and to refuse to let the Israelites go. His heart continues to be hardened. We've seen times, moments, where he has shown a certain amount of willingness to capitulate, but then quickly he's not so sure he wants to let him go after all. And we've seen the instances of that several times in the course of the nine plagues. So Pharaoh's resistance is the occasion in which God is able to escalate his activity and demonstrate more of his powers, demonstrate more of his character, in a sense, his patience. He's willing to wait and let people have a chance to make their choice, but makes it increasingly clear that he is the God of the universe. So we're building to the climax, and this kind of marks the climax of the plague narrative. Okay, how is it that God performed the plagues? That is to say, are these miracles, are they genuine miracles? When people hear the term miracles, the assumption is that it is a supernatural act, an act that violates the laws of chemistry and physics, is completely out of the ordinary, or breaks the laws of nature, is sometimes the way that it is put. I've thought about this some, and I'll explain my thinking, and then if there are questions about it afterwards, I would certainly welcome them. We can talk about it more. But it seems to me that there are two ways that God can reach into our reality in an overt way that draws attention to the fact that it is God himself who is acting here. One of those ways would be a supernatural act, as I've said, that one that breaks the laws of nature. But he can also do that, accomplish that same thing, it seems to me, through what one commentator calls hypernatural events. That is to say, it doesn't break the laws of chemistry and physics, but it is those laws of chemistry and physics coming together in a very unusual way that produces an event that is unprecedented. That is, on this scale, it's unprecedented. It has precedence, but they aren't on that scale. And that it is the context, then, that makes that event, that highly unusual event, significant and marks it as something that God is doing and God is using. It seems to me that God works in both of those ways. It is interesting that in these texts, in the Exodus, it never refers to the plagues as miracles. It doesn't use the word miracles. I don't know what the word for miracle would be in Hebrew, but it calls them signs and wonders. Sometimes they're called signs, sometimes they're called wonders. But they're things that grab our attention. They are so out of the ordinary that they grab our attention. And that could be either supernatural or hypernatural. The things that have to happen in order for it to be a wonder is, first of all, it has to be really attention-getting. It has to strike people in general as this is way out of the ordinary. Second, it has to be at the right time. It has to be in a context that gives this a significance that it wouldn't otherwise have. And third, it has to be meaningful and purposeful. It has to gain significance from that context. And it seems to me that these signs and wonders are intended to communicate. And I have listed as one of the qualities, it's for people in general. I would make a distinction between an event that gets my attention as an individual and a sign or wonder. Signs and wonders are for a broader audience than just me and maybe a couple people around me, that it's doing something more generally significant. I would argue then that the supernatural miracles, hypernatural miracles, both have these qualities. In the Bible, there are some of these wonders that appear to be according to the laws of nature. Later on, when the Israelites are going from the Transjordan into the Promised Land, they go through on dry land, but the narrative points out that the water was stopped upstream, apparently by a landslide. It was stopped upstream. So there is a physical cause given for them being able to cross the river on dry ground. So that appears to be according to the laws of nature. There are others that I can't come up with any way of explaining by the laws of nature. And one of those that we've already seen was when Moses was told to throw his staff down and it became a serpent. Then the magicians, they threw their staffs down and they became serpents. But then Moses' staff ate the serpents of the magicians. I have a difficult time coming up with any explanation by the laws of chemistry and physics that would account for that. Maybe it's possible. I mean, strange things happen that are according to the laws of physics and chemistry, but I don't know. I can't imagine one that would account for that. So it seems to me there are both that are represented in the Bible. And it seems to me that these plagues, certainly the first nine plagues, are of the hypernatural variety rather than the supernatural variety. There's a book by Colin Humphreys that I read. It's called The Miracles of Exodus. I think it's an interesting book. Some of it's compelling and some of it is not. Colin Humphreys is a scientist, taught and worked at Cambridge University. But in his later years, and I don't know if he's still alive or not, but in his later years, he started taking on the project of explaining miracles in the Bible by the laws of chemistry and physics. Not to undermine them, but just because he thinks that that's how most of them happened. I looked at a blog where someone was criticizing this book because it undermined the miracles of God, and he responded to it, and he made it clear he believes that these are acts of God. He just conformed to the laws that he built into the universe to bring them about, and he's trying to figure out how that happened. But he says some are not explicable. He thinks some of them break all the laws of chemistry and physics. So he's not trying to undermine them. He's just trying to give an account for them, those that can be given an account. He goes through and explains many of the miracles in Exodus. Some of those explanations I find compelling. Some of them, I just don't see how it can fit in and make sense of the narrative as the narrative stands. But what he says about the plagues, I found very interesting. He is building on some work that has been done that started a half century ago. There are commentators who have looked at Exodus who have noticed that some of the plagues seem to be in a cause and effect relationship. That is, one plague seems to set up the preconditions for another plague. That has long been recognized and commented on. The first one person that I'm aware of that thought at all about this chain of events that could account for at least some of the plagues was Flinders Petrie in 1911, where he strung together several of the plagues. But it wasn't until 1957 and 58 that someone sat down and really tried to figure out what is the species and genus of each animal actor in this chain of events and explain all of the biology that was involved in the plagues. And that was Greta Hort, who was a teacher of English literature, interestingly, at an unpronounceable university in Denmark. And she strung together the first seven plagues, so those all fit together, and gave an explanation for each one and how it led into the next one. That concept was developed in much more detail in 1997 by a couple of doctors, Dr. John Marr and Dr. Curtis Malloy, both of whom worked in the field of public health in New York City. So very familiar with epidemics and those kinds of issues, and decided to look at the account in Exodus and see if they could identify what were the causes of each plague and how did they set up the preconditions for the next plague. Colin Humphreys then went back and reworked what Marr and Malloy did, made just a few kind of minor adjustments, and then strung it all together there and explained it in his book. And I found that very interesting. So I'm going to present to you the essence of what Colin Humphreys said, which is primarily the same as what Marr and Malloy had said. So the first plague, the Nile was turned to blood. The first thing that is worthy of note is that there is a document, an Egyptian document that dates to about 1600 BC. So it's before, it's a couple hundred years before even the earliest possible date for the Exodus. In this document, it lists several curses that befell Egypt, and one of those was the Nile turning to blood. And there are about three others that it mentions that are all events that occurred in the plague account in Exodus. So there are about four bad things that happened in Egypt prior to this occurrence of the Exodus, at least a couple hundred years before the Exodus. It is thought that the first plague would correspond to a flooding of the Nile. When the Nile floods, typically that happens in the months of June through September, but the flooding starts out rather gently, and the biggest floods come at the end of that period, in the September time frame. When it floods, it typically carries a lot of red silt in it, and it can be very silty during those flood periods. So that would, at least in part, account for the color of the Nile. The color would have been red just as a result of a large flood. However, when that happens, it's not deadly to the fish, it's not deadly to the frogs, and as a result, flooding can't account for what we have described in Exodus. So, it is believed then that this flooding was accompanied with a red tide. Now, you've probably all heard of a red tide. A red tide is a phenomenon where you have a rapid proliferation of a certain kind of aquatic, microscopic critter, and it turns the water a shade of red, and it is toxic often. Not all of them are toxic. Not all red tides are toxic, but some of them are toxic to fish and animals in the water. It was thought that red tides only occur in the oceans, in salt water, but it has since been recognized that they occur in estuaries as well. So in those areas where the salt water mixes with fresh water, red tides can occur there as well. And much of Egypt is the delta area, and much of that is estuary. The requirements for a red tide is that there be long hours of daylight, that there be warm temperatures, and the water be rich in nutrients, all of which could have been met in the month of September in Egypt. So what they are speculating is that the Nile turning to blood was a combination of high floodwaters carrying a lot of red silt and a red tide coinciding with that, that would have killed the fish. And the fish would have died several days to a few weeks after the bloom started, depending on what kind of bloom it was. And it's interesting, they say, we don't know what kind of algal bloom it would have been, because ever since the building of the Aswan Dam, the estuaries have been changed such that we don't know what would have been there in times past. The Aswan Dam has wiped out all of those, has changed all of that such that we can't go back and figure that out. So that's the first plague. Second plague, frogs. It is common in Egypt for frogs to be at their maximum in November, and there are a lot of frogs in the Nile at that time of year, generally speaking. They would have been driven out of the water due to both the red algae and as a result of the dying fish. The dying fish, I have to get all of my biology right, the dying fish would have used up oxygen, is that, I think that's right, would have used up oxygen in the water and forcing the frogs to leave because they don't have enough oxygen. They go out in search of other bodies of water where they can go, and also looking for food. So the frogs are driven out of the river, and they're going everywhere, and that matches the description that we have in Exodus. And not able to find water where they can live, they die from hunger and thirst. So now, as it says in the account, we've got these piles of frog corpses all over the place, everywhere. The third plague, then, is gnats, and the Hebrew word is not specific. It could refer to several different insects, but most likely it refers to some kind of midge or some kind of mosquito. But, as Marr and Molloy point out, there is a later plague that can best be accounted for if these gnats are a certain kind of midge. Because these midges lay eggs on decaying animals, and this Colocoides canothorax is the most likely culprit, and that will play into the fifth plague. So that's what they're speculating, is this specific midge that was born in huge numbers in the third plague. The fourth plague is flies. And Marr and Molloy go through various candidates as to what kind of fly this would have been. There are a number of possible candidates. But they settle on the stable fly as being the most likely. And the scientific name is written there in the notes, if you have the notes. The Stomoxys calcitrans. Sounds like something in California. Transportation system, but whatever it is, the stable fly, it swarms. Not all flies swarm, but this one does. And in the account, it says that there were swarms of flies. It breeds quickly. It produces painful bites. Apparently, they are very painful. And this particular fly bites mainly the feet and the legs, the lower extremities, which is interesting. Both these midges and these flies were kept in check in general by frogs eating them. Their main predator is frogs. But the frogs all died in the second plague, so now these insects are all over the place. The fifth plague, pestilence. It indicates in the account that there's a wide range of animals that are affected by this pestilence. So there aren't very many ways that you can account for all of those different species of animals being affected. That is, horses, I can't remember what all it says. Horses, cattle, camels are listed. So the question is, what could affect that range of species? Plus humans. No, let's see. No humans were killed with this plague. Okay, so not humans. So there's no one virus that will meet all of these requirements. But there are two viruses that could account for this. And both of these viruses are carried by the same insect, and that is this particular kind of midge carries both of those viruses. So if this particular kind of midge proliferated, there's the possibility then that it could have been the vector for both of these viruses, viruses that affect the animals and viruses that affect people. I'm sorry, doesn't affect people, different kinds of animals. And the two viruses that they think are the culprits here. One is the African horse sickness, which kills horses. And the second one is what's called blue tongue, which kills cattle, sheep, goats, and camels, accounting for all of the species that were affected by the fifth plague. The sixth plague, boils. They postulate that this, and boils again, that's a vague term in the Hebrew. It's not clear what that identifies. But they say that it fits the characteristics of glanders or Pseudomonas male, I guess, which causes a boil-like lesion on both men and animals. It is highly contagious, and in fact, there are some countries that have tried to make this into a biological weapon. Highly contagious, it can spread through the air or by direct contact. But it is very common with insect bites, and the stable fly would create a place for that to develop. The seventh plague is hail. So no one gives a means by which hail was caused by any of the previous six plagues. So the first six fit into a cause and effect relationship. The seventh one does not. There is hail, and so the presumption here is that this is a natural occurrence. Hail is rare in Egypt, but it is attested. It does happen occasionally. And the conditions would have to have been just right to create the size of hailstones that are described in the account. So this one was not caused by any of the preceding plagues, but it does set up the preconditions for one of the plagues yet to come. It points out that this happened during the time when the flax and the barley were about to be harvested. Interestingly, flax and barley, we know, were harvested at the same time in Egypt during this time period. But, and this is all what I have read, it depends on what you're going to do with flax when you harvest it. You'll harvest it at different times depending on what you're going to do with that flax. The uses that they put flax to at this period of time when the Exodus would have occurred meant that they needed to harvest it at the same time that they harvested barley. But in later times in Egypt, those two crops were not harvested at the same time. That becomes significant later. Okay, so this, the seventh plague, would most likely have happened in the February to March period of time. The eighth plague, locusts. Again, this is not caused by any of the previous plagues. Plagues of locusts have affected the world at various times, and some of them have been horrendous. Some of them have been multi-year plagues of locusts that have occurred in Africa as well as Southeast Asia. So this is not out of the realm of possibility or whatever. You just would have had to have had the right set of circumstances for it to happen at this time. Locusts are attracted to damp soil. They need 4 inches of moisture in the soil in order for them to lay their eggs and to propagate themselves. Interestingly, in Plague 7, it said there was hail, but then that was followed by rain. So it got fairly wet. And it must have been wet enough for that moisture to penetrate 4 inches down in the soil so that these locusts could breed, and that's apparently what happened. Generally speaking, the locusts can't fly very well. They fly with the wind. It would have required an east wind to bring the locusts in. That's according to the account in Exodus. An east wind did that. The ninth plague then, darkness. It's assumed that this one is accounted for by a khamsin, which is a sandstorm coming in and obscuring the sun. These are not uncommon in Egypt. They usually occur in the spring, and the first one of the year is usually the worst because it picks up all the lightest soil and carries it. And this would make good sense on a year when you have a particularly heavy flood. You'd have more than the average amount of silt lying around on the ground, and that's what would be picked up by the winds, and that's what would fill the air and block the sun. Okay, the 10th plague then, and this is Marr and Molloy's greatest contribution to what Hort had speculated. They argue that they think there's a way to account for the death of the firstborn. According to the account in Exodus, the Egyptians harvested their grain under circumstances in which the grain was most likely wet. So the grain is harvested, the grain is piled in their storehouses, and after the grain is harvested and stored, we have the locusts coming in, and the locusts are everywhere, and as a result, there will be locust feces on the grain that's in the piles. Given that combination of moisture and locust feces, there's a mycotoxin that could very well have grown on the grain. And it's Macrocyclic trichothecines or whatever. So this is infecting the top layer of the grain wherever it is stored. We have come through a period of time when there have been several things that have affected the food supply for the Egyptians. They are probably very hungry. And in periods of time when there is hunger, in cultures where the firstborn are highly valued, they get the first food. So what's speculated is the top layer of food goes to the firstborn. And the top layer of food is going to be the most toxic. As you get down below the top layer, it's no longer toxic. The mycotoxin is only growing in that top layer, the very top. And they speculate that that could even be true of the animals, the firstborn being the strongest, the most aggressive. They're getting to the food first, and they're the ones eating the mycotoxins and dying. So that's their account for even the 10th plague, the plague of the death of the firstborn. Okay, I find this explanation of how these plagues occurred, according to the natural laws, I find it compelling until we get to the 10th. From my perspective, I think the 10th is a great try. I just have a difficult time buying it completely. It is interesting, Noam Sarna, a Jewish commentator who's, I love his commentary. I find it very helpful, very insightful. He makes the comment, he thinks they are all natural occurrences except the 10th. He thinks that is supernatural, and he thinks that that is fitting for a variety of reasons. We'll talk about that later. And I tend to agree with him. Okay, but if this is true, if the first nine are all natural occurrences, that is, they occur according to the laws of nature, then we can put these into a timeline. These all nine plagues, all 10 plagues, occurred within about an 8-month period of time. And we can specify what month each of these plagues occurred in. And as it turns out, it's a little better than one plague per month. So if you think of yourself as an Egyptian experiencing these, every month, it's a little less than a month, a new plague hits us. And that's got to be psychologically difficult. So they would start in September, and they would go for 8 months, ending in March, putting us at the time of the Passover, and that's when the Passover then is celebrated and is still celebrated. Okay, a summary of this is all on the chart, and so you can see it here. It has a list of each of the plagues, the causes, and then it gives you the time of year. And so you can see how we move through the 9 months and get to the time of the Passover. What is interesting about this is there are a number of things that are interesting about this accounting of how the plagues occurred. First of all, as I want to talk about more next week, these plagues are a big, big deal. And it's in particular, the Passover event and then the Exodus are a big deal that Israel was supposed to remember forever. But it was not thoroughly remembered. I think that it is the case that it was not remembered in the way that God had asked them to remember it. And it has been, in the imagination of the world in general, this has been relegated to a myth-like status, that it didn't actually happen. There are many scholars who take the perspective that the plagues did not happen, at least not the way described in Exodus, and that the Exodus did not happen, at least the way described in Exodus. And there are many who would argue that this account that we find in Exodus wasn't written until 800 BC or 700 BC. So this accounting of natural causes for the plagues is interesting because even down to details, they can be accounted for by our knowledge of biology and environmental sciences. For instance, the harvesting of flax at the same time as barley was harvested. That's commented on in the text. Someone in Israel trying to write this account in 700 or 800 BC would be unlikely to know that in the 1400s BC that those two were harvested at the same time. So if it's true that this accounting is reasonably accurate, It gives credibility to the account that we can only have assurance of now with modern scientific knowledge at a time when we don't have other ways of knowing that it did indeed happen the way the Bible said that it happened. I think, this is my wild speculation, but I think that the plagues in the Exodus are of such significance that sometime there will be archaeological evidence found that makes it clear that it was indeed a historical event. Because the historicity, the fact that this did happen, is really important in the history of Israel. And I think it would be very godlike for him at this time in history to make that obvious, to make that known to anyone who has ears to hear. Okay, I think that I will leave the next three pages of outline for next week, given the fact that time is just about out. So I will, next week I'm going to be devoting most of the time to talking about the plagues in general and the significance of the plagues. But at this point, I'll just throw it open for questions and comments.
In the fifth plague, it says that all the livestock of Egypt died, but then it goes on to say the other plagues from that point on affected the livestock. So right. How does that work?
Right. All does not mean all the time. It is common. There are several instances of this in the Old Testament narratives where it will say all, but the narrative itself makes it clear that it can't mean each and every one. It's saying all in the sense of a whole bunch. It's not each and every one, but it's a whole bunch. And we do that all the time, right? We take that kind of flexibility with language. We use it. We have to grant it to the biblical authors as well. And so that's, you have to take it that way as you read it. It doesn't necessarily mean each and every one.
David, thank you. Mm-hmm. Are you going to talk about theological reflections of the plagues next week in terms mm-hmm. of, okay, with respect to the first plague, Nile turned to blood, I'm not a fundamentalist that needs these things to be like totally outside of the laws of physics.
Right.
And I've read similar sort of accountings of these things, and it's very interesting. But at the end of the day, the text really pushes us away from this the modern ethos of wanting to understand how these things could happen and place it back squarely on Yahweh and on Yahweh's agent, Moses. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is with the blood, both Moses as well as the magicians are supposedly being, the narrative places the onus on both of them, that Moses is able to do this thing and then the magicians. And I would imagine that a sort of red tide flood scenario would make it difficult for one to be able to pinpoint, oh, here's this individual, his staff is touching the water, and voila, kind of thing. And I didn't know if you'd thought about that, or it's not a big deal. It was just sort of interesting that both the magicians as well as Moses are.
I don't think the magicians are able to reproduce that one.
It says that they are.
Well, they did?
Yeah. It's not a big deal. I was just curious if you had sort of thought about that with respect to the natural causes.
Okay. My assumption is that there are only a couple of things that the magicians do. And my assumption is that some kind of trickery that brings about a facsimile of what Moses has done. And there's another one where it's difficult because the text says that he turned all the waters to blood. But then he asked the magicians, and they are able to do it. Well, how? I thought the water was already all blood. What are they turning to blood? So I'm not sure exactly how to account for that. But I'm not sure you're going to have to come back at me with another question. But what Moses is able to do is clearly several notches above what the magicians are able to produce in its scope and in its such that I think any discerning viewer would be able to tell that this they are qualitatively different things that have occurred here. Now, come back.
It was just something that I went back to, and I was looking at, and it says, so Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded, chapter 7, verse 20. And he lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile, in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, and all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. And the fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink from the Nile, and the blood was through all the land of Egypt. Mm-hmm. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, as the Lord said. So, yeah, I mean, it was curious. Again, this is not an attempt to sort of undermine the thesis that you're forwarding, but I was curious how there could be a distinction between, with this particular event, how there could be a distinction between what Moses was able to do versus what the magicians were able to do.
Right, right. I don't know the answer to that. It does say elsewhere, when it's talking about throwing down the staffs, it says that they were able to do it by their trickery or something, by their secret arts. So it's by their trickery. I really think that there would have been a qualitative difference between what Moses performed and what the magicians performed. It is only through the eyes of one who wishes that it were true that the magicians could do the same thing, that they would see it that way. That's good enough. That's close enough to what Moses did. But I really think there's a qualitative difference. But I still think that it's probably the case that what Moses did was according to the rules of nature, that God orchestrated in such a way that that happened then.
Sure. Yeah, I'll just leave it at that. That's good. That's good. Thanks, David.
Yeah. Sorry.
There's really two ways that you can take in 22, but the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts. One of them would be that they duplicated the miracle that Moses had just performed. But the other one is an explanation for why Pharaoh didn't believe. The magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret hearts, so Pharaoh's heart was hardened and he did not listen to them. That is, in other words, he wasn't impressed because for in the past, his own magicians had done the same thing.
Yeah.
And your explanation, or the explanation of what's his name, makes it very clear why they could have done that. Their secret art would be they knew enough about the patterns of the flooding and the algae blooms that if they wanted to deceive people, they find out, whoop, it's happening, let's go to the people and tell them what we're going to do, and lo and behold, the Nile turns red. So I'm inclined to read it that Pharaoh is just saying, yeah, no big deal, my magicians have done that.
Yeah, yeah. Now that I recall, I think that's the most likely explanation.
Context, though, of the folks doing it right after Moses with the staffs, it feels like in chapter 8 that it's difficult to know contextually or to place that on some sort of historical background versus like something that happens in the moment.
Right. With that one, I think that it has to have been then, because Moses' staff eats their staffs.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Magicians are one of my two favorite performers to watch. And in fact, I've been watching magicians lately on YouTube. They are so good. There's actually a man out there who has a long video proving that magicians are demonically inspired and assisted in their work. And when you see some of the things they do, may I borrow your cell phone, claps his hands, and now it's inside a jar, a bottle that it can't come out of? These guys are amazing. So for an Egyptian magician to say, what, I got to turn the water red and make it poisonous to fish? Give me a minute. It's a child's trick, really. And they didn't have microscopes. They didn't know why the water was red. They didn't know why it was toxic. But if you want red water that'll kill fish, any 12-year-old magician with a chemistry kit can pull that off. It's not difficult. But they couldn't do the things that took time. They could do the things on the spur of the moment, which means they had a bag of tricks. But they couldn't make gnats appear out of nowhere. They couldn't bring boils upon people.
Right.
Things that just can't fake that. But so I don't have any trouble with that one. I just want to let you know that I'm really, really enjoying this. This is the first time I've noticed that it wasn't burning hail. It was hail and fire.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the whole Charlton Heston thing stuck with me. This is the first time I've noticed that the Passover meal wasn't lamb. It was lamb or goat.
Mm-hmm.
I've never noticed that before.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got us, at least me, really paying attention.
Good.
And as far as the blue tongue thing, I can vouch for that. 4 years ago, blue tongue swept through the deer herd in southern Illinois. It's caused by drought in which the animals have fewer and fewer watering places, and they all become congregating at fewer and fewer places. And when one has blue tongue, the bugs transfer right up the noses to those that are drinking with it.
Hmm.
So blue tongue wiped out the herd because the ones that weren't going down to the river started congregating around the fewer and fewer watering holes.
Hmm.
And the wildlife biologist said, this happens every time we have a drought.
Hmm.
So these poor animals were being watered out of the Nile. They were just going for what they could, and they were spreading the disease among themselves, just like the deer do in southern Illinois when there's a drought. So I can say, yeah, that's a plausible explanation.
Let's do one more.
Hi, David. Thank you. I appreciate your scholarship and your research, and I have not done all of that research. I guess I feel like the voice of one crying in the wilderness here. I find the arguments about these not being entirely supernatural to be very contrived and really unnecessary. We certainly, I think everybody in this room, believes that God is capable of performing all of these acts in a totally miraculous way. And although they may have some evidentiary value if they are simply well-timed and so on, they would certainly have more evidentiary value if they were truly supernatural. And so I guess maybe if I did more research, I would be convinced that they are not entirely supernatural. But at this point, all the explanations just seem really contrived.
Okay. But let's, as far as being evidentiary, if they are truly supernatural, then no timeline can be given to them. Would you grant that? And the other thing is, if they are totally supernatural, then no account can be given that would lend authenticity to them at this point in history. You see what I'm saying?
But I don't think you need any more support for the veracity of Scripture. You don't need that.
If someone is dubious as to whether this is a historical account or not, whether it actually happened, if they are all truly supernatural, there's no means by which to determine that at this point in time. But if they were not supernatural, if they were hypernatural, then to go back and give an accounting like this, that is, that accounts for details that someone composing it at another time in history could not possibly have put together, and in a way that even someone at the time that it occurred wouldn't have had the scientific knowledge to put together, I find that interesting. There is evidentiary value there, it seems to me.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.